Have a dope day.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Stop.
Good morning. Welcome to the Truth to Power Show on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, VGR Nathan, and with us today is our co-host, Claire Van Winkle.
Good morning.
Good morning. And our guest today is Sharon Gruskin. Sharon Gruskin is the author of the debut novel, The Forgetting Time. In addition to writing fiction, she has worked as a writer and producer of award-winning
documentaries.
I was going to say democracy, because we just follow democracy now. Thinking of that, including Stolen and On Meditation. She began exploring the ideas examined in The Forgetting Time when she worked at a refugee camp in Thailand as a young woman and later served as a hospice volunteer soon after the birth of her first child. She's been a fellow at YADO, Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, Blue Mountain Center, and Ragdale, and has degrees from Yale University and Columbia University School for the Arts. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and two sons. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So why don't we start a little bit from the introduction about the genesis of The Forgetting Time. And
maybe you can tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah.
Sure.
Those of you out in Radio Land who aren't fortunate enough to have it in front of you.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Well, The Forgetting Time, it's basically about a single mom in Brooklyn whose four-year-old son seems to, you know, has terrible nightmares, seems sort of like haunted by something that she can't quite get her finger on. Like he's has problems at school and basically she becomes so beside herself about the situation with her son that she brings in this professor whose job is that he investigates cases of children who seem to remember previous lifetimes. And then the two of them go on this journey, and this very skeptical kind of Brooklyn mom ends up kind of having her mind blown, basically. The book is based on real research done at University of Virginia. So into children who seem to have memories of previous lifetimes. So that's kind of the arc of the book. There's another family that they end up, I don't want to spoil
too much.
It's basically about this journey of this mom and her son and this kind of fringe scientist and where they end up going.
Okay, yeah. Great.
So why don't we start with, then we were saying about in the introduction, they say you worked at a refugee camp, and this kind of how, is this how the novel started to settle into your mind, or is how the first genesis of the idea start to come to you?
I think the refugee camp was really more just my first introduction to people who believed in reincarnation. I was quite young when I was like 20 years old in Thailand working with refugees from Cambodia and Laos. And when I left, everyone was like, see you next life. And it was kind of like we would think it's a joke, like, oh, see you next life, ha, ha, ha. But it was like there was a sense of like not completely a joke, maybe.
Yeah.
So that was just a little like a twinge. When I had two younger children and I started volunteering at a hospice, just sort of helping people who were facing imminent death. When you're in that position, I think, like a lot of people, perhaps I hadn't really spent much time thinking about what happens when you die. Maybe not. Maybe everybody thinks about this all the time. But for me, it was sort of like, these people are like dying and I haven't thought deeply about what do I think about that? What do I think about, you know, what happens to you? And so I became kind of really interested, interested isn't even the right word, sort of like deeply concerned that I needed to know more about even what I thought about this. And around this time, my stepmom was cleaning out her garage and she handed me this book and she said, well, you might be interested in this. And it was a book called Old Souls by Tom Schroeder, who's a Washington Post reporter, Miami Herald reporter, I believe it. And he, in the book, he followed this man, Dr. Ian Stevenson from University of Virginia, around. And what Dr. Ian Stevenson did was he investigated these cases of little kids who, from the time they could speak, would say, you know, my name is not Suzanne, my name is Hammam, and my husband's name is Farouk, and I have three kids, and these are their names. And they would give these incredibly detailed sort of stories about who they were. And Dr. Stevenson and his sort of colleagues would then try to find out who this child seems to be remembering being. And so eventually they would take, you know, a number of kids. A lot of these cases are in Asia and sort of in India and other places. And so they would take the child maybe to a village that seemed to meet the description and some of the details. And in about, 3,000 cases, the kid would identify things and identify people. And so they would be able to say, oh, you were my uncle, or, you know, did my brother give you the stuff he was supposed to give you when I passed away? And so these cases blew my mind, you know, when I read about them, and I could talk about them for a long time. So they're really mind blowing. They're amazing. And the people investigating them are, you know, it's called the Division of Perceptual Studies at University of Virginia. And they're, you know, Dr. Stevenson was the head of the psychiatric program there. The man, Dr. Tucker, who's heading it now, also is the head of the clinic, and he's a professor in the medical school there. So they're very serious people investigating this. And so, this concept really sort of took hold of me. And as a writer, I started to percolate in my mind, thinking this could be an interesting story. Mm-hmm. This is unusual. And then I had these two little kids. And so I started to think for my own life, you know, I think anybody who has either kids or has been a kid or has a sibling understands that we come out differently from each other, even if our parents are the same. And I started to ask myself, well, why are some people, you know, one of them is, you know, scared of this thing and the other one isn't. You know, could that be something that happened before they were born? Could that be from a past life? So anyway, it all sort of percolated and came together in this story about this mom who's trying to figure out why her child is acting the way he's acting.
Yeah, I know that sometimes in the last episode, we were talking a little bit about how the truth and fiction and how I think Claire posed the question about whether or not fiction gets deeper into truth than sometimes just get presented case studies. Like, for example, in this book, you know, you present some case studies that are interspersed in some of the chapters. But the prose actually sometimes gets, you know, how do you feel writing fiction accesses the truth of the case studies a little bit more deeply, maybe? Or what was the choice between, like, just representing case studies and then deciding to tell a story about a mother and her child.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. So sometimes I've had the question asked opposite, like, why did you put case studies in your novel?
Yeah.
But I actually like the way you asked it better. I mean, because honestly, the reason that I made a story about it is because I'm a novelist and I'm not really a journalist. Yeah. And I And but I did feel really strongly that these stories are really compelling. These cases are really compelling. And Dr. Tucker's had a number of books focused on the cases. You know, again, if we have time, I'll just go and say some of them because they're quite something. Like for instance, that little girl that one I mentioned, was a little girl in Lebanon who, from the time she could speak, she'd say, "My name is not Suzanne. My name is Hammam. And my husband's name is Farouk, and I have these three daughters." And then eventually there was another family who lived hours away who heard about this girl because their mother, Hammam, had gone to the States to have a heart operation. And her daughter Layla was supposed to come with her, but she couldn't, and at the last minute and the woman died over there. And so this little girl kept picking up the phone and saying, "Layla, Layla, Layla." And the other family decided to check up on this little girl because they were skeptical, and they showed up just at the house. And the little girl identified each of the grown women by name that were Hammam's daughters. Oh, wow. She asked them if they'd received the very specific pieces of jewelry they were supposed to receive. And she was like four or five at this point. When she heard that Farouk had remarried, she was distraught. And she was like, "How could you remarry? You said you would only love me, you know?" And it was like the real powerful emotion. Anyway, as you can tell, I'm very passionate about the cases. And so I felt like I just want people to know about these cases. I think they're interesting. And I also think they make a good story. And I really wanted the book to not be just like a fantasy, like a ghost story, like I wanted people to understand this isn't just something I made up. This is something I dramatized. I made up my own version of, but it's out there. And you can, I mean, of course, you know, people reject them and have all kinds of reasons that they decide they don't believe in them, which is fine. The beauty of it from my end is I am only a novelist. So I don't have to convince anyone of anything. Yeah. But I like the idea of like maybe the book will cause people to kind of open their minds, at least for the length of reading the book, and just think about, well, what do I think about these cases? What do I think about this possibility? So it's just really important to me to have that in there to kind of provoke people a little bit to so that they couldn't just completely dismiss it. Of course, people do completely dismiss it all the time. Yeah.
Can I ask, so you used this real doctor, you used him as a character in your book?
I created my own version of him.
Did you have any particular strategies for coming up with, I don't know if you'd call them parallel characters, or for integrating the essence of a real person into your dramatized story? How did you as a writer handle that? How did you choose? Did you just simply change the names, I'm assuming, or how did you process those characters?
It's an interesting question because I definitely felt a certain amount of pressure. I should say Dr. Stevenson had passed away when I was writing the book, but Dr. Tucker, who was his protege and who heads up the Division of Perceptual Studies, investigating these children's cases, was very close to him. So I spent, I spent some time interviewing Dr. Tucker, and then I made up a name. Dr. Stevenson became Dr. Anderson, maybe not the most clever, clever version of it. I think as with a lot of writers, he's a bit of a composite. So like his physical manifestation and some aspects of him came from my very first writing teacher, Peter Matheson, who had a huge impact on me. And it was a very spiritual person. So I kind of brought that into it. Mm-hmm. But I knew that Dr. Stevenson was incredible, he was really obsessed with these cases. And really, it's been decades of his life just tirelessly, into his 80s, traveling the world, documenting them. So it was kind of the energy, his energy and his meticulous scientific kind of outlook that I was trying to capture. And Dr. Tucker said at one point after he had read the book, he said something like, I think you captured the spirit of Ian, of Dr. Stevenson. And that was probably the comment about the book that I was happiest with.
Can I ask you, so I teach writing at CUNY, and students frequently ask questions about, can I write this story? Is it okay to take this approach to write to writing something that might be about the real world? And I usually default to saying, well, yeah, write it. Just be open to whatever feedback you get. Would, if you had not been able to personally meet and interview Dr. Tucker, if you had had to just go off research, do you think you still would have undertaken this project? Just out of curiosity, because I also love the idea of integrating research with writing. And just for those writers out there who might have a project that is even less accessible than all of these past lives.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I was really glad that I had the opportunity, that he was very generous and met with me, and I got to know him a little bit. In some ways, largely because, you know, the research, of course, and I spent some time, you know, I did some transcription for him of some cases. And so that was very helpful, and helped him as well. But also the credibility that he brought to it, like Dr. Tucker, and I say this, I mean, he's an amazing person, but he would almost be boring if he weren't talking about like kids' past lives. He's so conscientious, this man. He's very scientific. He's this conscientious sort of scientist. And it was so important for me personally to meet him so that I knew in my own heart, like, these people are not crackpots.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Would I have embarked on the book if I hadn't had the opportunity to do that? You know, it's hard to say. Probably I would have. I mean, I think in the past I've been shy about really going to meet with people. And I guess I would encourage writers in general, don't be shy, because it's just better. Whatever texture and experience, even just the way someone talks, it's just better to do it. And people generally are much, you know, kinder and open, more open than you think. And I think, you know, it's easy these days to just pull up on a computer and get mm-hmm. all this information. But being in a room with someone is a different experience. So,
did this the act of interviewing this man or the other people who you may have met over the course of this project, did that help you with writing dialogue? Is that something that you integrate when you're talking about people's speech patterns or things like that as a writer?
In this case, in subtle ways. I mean, Dr. Tucker also, he lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, and my character does not. So it was like,
okay, yeah.
You know, so there's certain like, but on the other hand, just the care with which he spoke kind of imprinted itself upon my, you know, upon my consciousness and my intention. And I think more than anything, you know, when you meet with people, you're like, oh, this guy is a person, he's a guy, and he's doing this work. And it made me more dedicated to try to do justice to what they were doing.
So your character was like Dr. Tucker in a past life.
Kind of. <it's> like, or maybe Dr. Stevenson is coming back as something else. I don't know. But
I know from the book that you quote the Emma Dickinson poem that might be relevant to this discussion. I'll just read the poem quickly. It's tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success and circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. So it was interesting to tell the truth, to tell it slanted, or tell it slant. And it's something that comes up about getting at the truth at a slant. So what does that mean to you, and how does that inform kind of this process that we're talking about, like taking things that are out there and kind of internalizing them and giving that kind of perspective? Yeah.
I think, you know, to me, it's the truth, you know, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. At one point, I wanted the book to be called The Truth Must Dazzle Gradually, or then the truth must dazzle and everybody convinced me out of it, which is probably a good thing. But I think, you know, it's a question of, you know, these are very deep, they're profound topics. What happens when you die? You know, does this happen when you die? And I think that we have a lot of resistance, first of all, to even thinking that we die, which is kind of silly, but it's true because it's so, it kind of freaks us out. And then, you know, people are constantly shouting, you know, telling things about this happens or that happens or whatever, or it's nothing. We know it's nothing, you know. So I think we have a lot of either kind of like, you know, there's a lot of confusion and fear around these topics. And I think that a process of kind of deeply exploring it and figuring out for oneself what one thinks or believes is, it has to be gradual and kind of almost gentle, almost careful, you know. I think it's, you know, it's a process, basically. And for me, you know, hearing these, you know, it was a process for me too, frankly. When I started writing the book, I did not necessarily believe that in reincarnation. I thought, you know, as I said, I thought it was fascinating. These cases were fascinating. I thought it'd be a good story. I also wanted to get a book published. I was like, this is a good story. Maybe people would like to read this. You know, there were a lot of, you know, so I was intrigued and I was sort of interested in the topic, but I didn't have what I would say belief in it. And really, it was through this process of doing the research, thinking I was doing the research for this novel, meeting with Dr. Tucker, thinking I'm meeting with a guy to do the research for the novel. And then somewhere along the process for myself, I had to stop and say, okay, but what do you think about this? And at that point, I was like, well, I think Dr. Tucker is really compelling. And I think these cases are really extraordinary, and I can't come up with a better explanation for them. And I also, you know, and this started with it when I was researching the book, and then just has blown up since then. People just tell me all of these stories. So many people have crazy stories about all sorts of things that just indicate so clearly to me that the world isn't as we perceive it to be most of the time. And so I had to conclude at the end, oh, I actually believe this myself. And then, you know, that just kind of opened a door to like, okay, well, what are you going to do about it? And where are you going to go with that? But so in other words, I think that it's a process of exploration that everybody, you know, I would encourage people to do it. I mean, this feels a little presumptuous to say that, but I guess my hope with the book is just like, even, you know, even for the span of the book, just to kind of have an open mind and think, do I think this is the case or not? I think that's useful, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, the title, The Forgetting Time, and what you think about the role of forgetting and remembering play. Because, you know, I can barely remember, you know, what happened to me, you know, a couple months ago. Sometimes certain events, I think, leave a deep impression on you, or certain things leave a... you know, events or occurrences leave deep imprints in your mind. But then other times, you know, it's easy to forget things. And that's, of course, the part of the process. But these people, these case studies will remember things that happened in previous lives. So what do you think is the process of forgetting and the thinking behind creating Ultimately the Title, Forgetting Time?
Well, the, I mean, 75% of the cases of the very young children who are documented to have memories that seem to coincide with somebody who lived and died, 75% of them had some kind of traumatic death. Yeah. And that's what they're remembering, you know. There's also this kind of crazy detail. I say crazy, but, you know, Dr. Stevenson spent a lot of time and wrote a whole book trying to document it, that the mode of death of what he called the previous personality corresponds to birthmarks and birth defects in the person that's born. So someone might have a terrible fear of guns or loud noises, say, and also like born with a hole in their chest, and then remembering, you know, a past life that there's some evidence for of somebody who was shot or something. Mm-hmm. That's just something that's a sort of variation on a particular case. But so there's a sense, a speculation perhaps, that, you know, that if you're going to remember something, you know, trauma is something that we tend to remember more deeply, and a sudden traumatic death could imprint itself so powerfully on a consciousness that it just kind of flows through. Now, these are the cases, you know, as I said, most of these cases of young children. There's other cases which is not what Dr. Stevenson really studies, of, you know, advanced, you know, Buddhist practitioners who seem to have access to previous lifetimes and stuff through their spiritual progress. But that's very different from these kids who are quite haunted by memories, you know, of something traumatic that happened to them. So, and also the forgetting time, just to go back to the title, you know, most of them tend to forget these memories by the time they're 5 or 6 or so. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you start going to kindergarten and this life just sort of really takes over. And so the forgetting time is kind of a play on, as a title, these, you know, that there is a time beyond which everybody forgets. And then also, if it's the case that we all had past lives, then we're all, you know, I don't know about you guys, maybe you remember, but I'm certainly in a forgetting time, which, yeah, I don't remember any of them. So that everybody's in a forgetting time in that way. Does that make sense?
Is, yeah, that that's good. And I think throughout the book, there's all these great insights into life and into our experiences. You know, I think there's a couple of quotes. There's a lot of things that are highlighted in the Kindle edition that's interesting about being in the present moment, or, you know, there's one about, you know, just generally speaking, like, that was pretty much it, wasn't it? You think you're in control, but you're really simply staring at the moving lights, things like these, where little phrases like this, which include kind of a deep sense of wisdom, you know? So, it's like, you know, a deep sense of uniqueness, you know? Yeah, unique insights, you know?
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
So tell us a little bit more about your exploration of philosophies and such, and what kind of philosophical traditions have influenced you.
I'm sorry, what was the beginning?
Exploration of philosophies and such?
Oh, philosophies.
Yeah.
I think, let's see, philosophies. I sort of became a Buddhist in the course of, you know, kind of right before I finished the book, basically. I would say I started practicing Buddhism, which came out of, as I said, this kind of belief that I started to kind of realize I had about past and future lives. I think, you know, in a way, I was more curious than sort of ascribing to any particular philosophy. I was raised kind of secular Jewish, never really had a strong feeling for it personally. And so I didn't, you know, I was kind of one of these agnostics, like, I think it's probably all going to be fine, no idea, but I'm just going to go with that. And that was kind of my philosophy of life, was like, probably fine when you die.
What am I going to do about it?
Yeah. That was kind of how I thought about it, you know? And so then once I was like, well, I think you might, you know, I think that perhaps I was born before and I might be, you know, and if that's the case, then I'm going to be born again as some other being, you know? And so how do I make that go well for me, basically, mm-hmm. in a way? Like, it just kind of started to open me up into thinking I better kind of explore this some more if I believe that this is true, because otherwise you're just saying, yep, well, it's the same thing. Like, okay, well, whatever happens, hope it's good, you know? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, around the time I was still finishing up research and had drafts of the book written, I started to attend meditation classes in New York City. It's a place called Kadampa Meditation Center, and there, it's a Buddhist approach, and it just started to make more and more sense to me. So while the book is very much like not a Buddhist book, because I wasn't a Buddhist when I wrote it, most of it, it definitely kind of spurred me along this kind of spiritual journey of my own. And now that makes, you know, it makes a ton of sense to me.
I'm a therapist also. Mm-hmm. I do writing therapy at Columbia University Medical Center at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. And even if one doesn't ascribe to Buddhist traditions, or if one isn't interested in the bigger picture of previous lives and future lives, even within the span of our own lives, we run in cycles of forgetting times. Mm-hmm. We kind of have multiple lives within each lifespan. And so many of my patients struggle with the idea of dealing with and processing memories that come up through the course of treatment. And the whole idea of, okay, now that I've accessed this memory that I've been suppressing, or this memory that I hadn't quite clicked into the greater span of this cycle I was going through in my life, what do I do with that now? How do I process it and let it go? What is it do we process a trauma, or do we forget it? Like, what is the difference between losing something and getting past something?
Yeah.
So I think that the whole idea of past lives is a wonderful thing to think about, whether you're doing so spiritually or even metaphorically within the span of our own lives. I think that's a very interesting way of looking at how all of these stories that we are kind of influence one another.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I think that's a very deep way of thinking about it. And I absolutely agree. I mean, we have many lives. We have many selves that we can choose to be or not to be. Sorry.
Yeah. Let's get some literary references here.
didn't mean that, Shakespeare. I apologize.
But who knows? Maybe that's you. Now.
No, I really don't think so. And from just the past life perspective, they found, you know, there are, I mean, Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Tucker were both psychiatrists, and there are people who do, you know, therapy with people. Also, you know, the psychiatrists at University of Virginia don't deal with, like, regression therapy, but there are people who have, you know, like, they go through a therapeutic process to maybe remember a past life. And the thought is, it doesn't even matter if it was. Part of it is to just accept that that's done with. It's over. Mm-hmm. That happened in the past. So a lot of these kids, when they sort of discover, you know, oh, this was the previous self and this person died, there's a sense of peace almost, because you kind of realize, oh, but I'm in this life now. That was before. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing can be said for within our own life, like our own memories. I mean, you never want to, I mean, repressing never helps, right? It's always just going to cause all sorts of other problems, whether physical or it's going to manifest in some way. But if we can, you know, if we can realize, this happened and that's not who I am. That's not who I have to be right this minute. And I can create a relationship. I can create a self this minute that has a relationship to that.
So
that
maybe
empowers me.
So maybe thinking about it less as, observing the truth and more of like bearing witness to what happened.
Right. Bearing witness in a way that can empower you.
That honors the existence of possibility and past without eclipsing the idea of the future or.
Exactly. Or even, you know, I mean, I think this is very much, in line with, you know, the Buddhist approach, but it's not just Buddhist. It could be therapeutic as well, that we have the freedom to create ourselves. You know, there is the selves that we seem to be is just some kind of like, you know, a bunch of feelings and emotions that we grasp onto and decide that this is me. You know, I mean, I had this myself. I don't want to go into this, but I had two books that didn't get published before this one. And I was really identified with, I need to prove to people I am a good writer. And I had a very like perfectionistic, you know, not good enough, going to prove to others kind of writer self that I was being when I wrote those books. And it's not really a surprise to me they didn't get published. And then with this one, it was like a totally different, I had a totally different approach, totally different person that I was wanting to write this book. Like, these stories are amazing. I'm interested in it. I'm going to write the book.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, that's just a very minor story, but like with any situation, with any trauma, to just say like, oh, do I, how do I want to identify myself in this situation? I don't have to be necessarily the overwhelmed person by this event. I could be the person who's going to empower oneself, or who's going to kind of use this to help others, you know.
To grow from it rather than growing out of it.
Right. Yeah. That there's flexibility there. We don't have to like just have an automatic response. And I think that's very true in therapy as well, right?
Can I ask you, so building on the same kind of theme about how we are more than one person and the way that we identify with ourselves and with our possible selves, how do you identify with the characters that you create? Because as writers, all of our characters come from us. I mean, they come from a lot of things, the people around us, the people we research, the ideas we have, the philosophies we study. But at the end of the day, you're the one putting all of those words on the page. And these characters are literally speaking through you. So how do you, and especially with a book like this that involved so much of a personal journey, can you talk just a little bit about that process of conjuring, I suppose?
I think, yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, you said they come from us and then through us. I mean, I would say they come through us, but not necessarily from us.
Right.
Because yeah. The whole book is ultimately just, you know, at a certain point you start to realize, oh, like my editor had a huge part in this book. Everything I've read has influenced this book. Dr. Tucker, Dr. Stevenson, you know, so it's, and all the people that I've met that kind of became manifest in the different characters. So it's like it's interesting that my name is on it, you know, and you're interviewing me. But like, really, I just kind of like, it just, I'm the one who kind of.
Like a medium.
Put it, yeah, sort of just put it together in this way. But, and you know, with characters, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, originally I identified a lot more with the I'm not a single mom. I'm a mom in Brooklyn. So I have a mom in Brooklyn, and I was like, oh, okay, that one's the one like me, right? It's interesting. That was the character Janie that I had the most trouble with. I kept having to rewrite her because she wasn't likable enough, which I think was just she was too much in her head. Or I mean, I think I was just having some problems with her. I was all kind of wrapped up, and this one is like me, but how is she? You know. Whereas some of the other characters, Dr. Anderson, and Denise, another character, kind of really came through me and seemed to have their own voices and seemed to have their own selves, so to speak, and were, I think, maybe even more successful as characters. And certainly, I think the one that the character I feel the best about just kind of showed up and had a very strong point of view. And I was like, okay, we're going to go with that, as opposed to me trying to kind of like get in there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just like, as with so many things, like kind of getting out of the way. This sort of conscious mind that thinks it has to figure it all out, getting out of the way, you can let characters sort of, and I don't know where they come from, but they will come if you get out of the way. The other character that was, you know, I think she came out okay in the end, mostly because I had to step away from her. And I was like, well, okay, I'm really disorganized, so she's going to be really organized. And I was like, she has a completely different career than I do. So the more I made myself different from her, the more she started to come into focus.
Mm-hmm. So one thing also I wanted to bring up about observation and consciousness, that in the review, in the book discussion questions, this comes up, that connects the events, the novel with Max Planck and the quantum physics, that events don't occur unless they are observed, and therefore the consciousness was fundamental, and matter itself was derived from it, perhaps. And did that therefore make this world like a dream, with each life, like each dream, flowing from one after the other? And that it is possible that some of us, like the children, are awakened too abruptly from these dreams and ache to return to them. So it's interesting when we talk about, like, you know, their own lives, the different days are being dreams, or, you know, breaking it down to each moment in our life being like a dream, and how that influenced you, you know, how would you think about that? Yeah.
I wish that I could talk about the quantum physicist in a really clear way. And I mean, I'll admit that I don't feel that I have a deep, deep understanding of quantum physics, but I have enough of an understanding, I think, to see that it's kind of like what they've shown through evidence, you know, through their research, through their experiments, is that, you know, the research that you know, a particle in one place will have an impact of another completely separate particle, seemingly separate particle somewhere else, you know, or that things react differently, whether they're observed or not. And I think all of this really just indicates powerfully that the way that we perceive reality is just not how reality actually exists, you know. And this strong statement, consciousness is fundamental, matter is derived from consciousness, it's so mind-blowing. It's so not how we live. I mean, the Buddha kind of said a similar thing, basically,
yeah.
2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's almost like too mind-blowing that it's hard for us to kind of think about it. Like, how can this life be like a dream? And I guess I'll just say, and this is very kind of mundane, perhaps, but just, you know, anecdotally hearing people's stories. If you're in any group of people, people have stories. People have things that occurred to them. People have, you know, inexplicable things and events and mystic moments. And there's all this information that we are getting, that's getting through to us a little bit, that things are more dreamlike than we're giving things credit for being, you know. And I think that, and the more you go along, you know, studying this stuff or you know, meditation and all of that stuff, all of, you know, these approaches, the more this seems not just, you know, plausible, but kind of the only thing that makes any sense ultimately. But I think, you know, I think, again, I'm a novelist, so I don't have to convince any of you.
Yeah.
I don't have to, but I will say that it's a powerful, you know, there's some powerful, you know, ideas out there that have to do with the nature of reality that we experience moment by moment. And it's good for us to kind of try to explore it personally.
Yeah. I think there is sort of a general trend that we as writers need to combat, where people tend to these days get frustrated when there aren't easy answers to things. And these ideas that the more we contemplate them, the more questions they raise rather than the more answers they yield. Yeah. I think these are the important questions and we need to make our heads hurt a little bit.
Yeah.
a little bit more often. And this is something that I see with a lot of my students, because I think that maybe it's part of our teaching toward testing. Maybe it's part of our kind of ends-focused educational system right now. But I think that a lot of people are getting really complacent in looking at discussions as expedient rather than exploratory.
Yeah.
And I think that questions like this that you're raising, and that this type of research and this type of open-mindedness raise, it should get people stirred up, and it should make us, we should be a little bit more uncomfortable sometimes.
Absolutely. I mean, it is very destabilizing, but it's also like that we're talking about the truth of
and,
our lives.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's why I'm saying that, that little bit of discomfort, that's how we know we're alive, right? When we're struggling, when we're struggling with reality. And then at the end of the day, there's this beautiful kind of dichotomy between, oh, we're so lost, but wait, here we are and life is happening now. And it's like, we can see that there's all of these other things that we can't possibly understand, but then no matter what, we are in the moment, in this present moment, and we can also honor that and be there. But humans have this capability to kind of go back and forth between those different perspectives. And it's something that isn't really appreciated as much in the day-to-day of our very logical, horribly illogical world.
Right, exactly. Logical. And, you know, people, you know, it's just about asking questions, and we don't have to be freaked out to ask ourselves these questions. We can ask them gently, mm-hmm. you know, within a moment by moment experience of trying, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, I mean, that's all, you know, I'm trying to do is ask questions with the book. And I also think like there's somebody once asked me actually in a radio show, so how does it work? Like, and I was like, what do you mean? How does what work? Like reincarnation, like how are you? And I was like, I'm a novelist.
Yeah. Where do I get my ticket?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're not going to break down the whole meaning of life for us bit by bit right now. That's not how we're going to finish.
I'm going to stick with, there are various, they're much wiser people than I who could do that, but not me.
And we can see even on a functional level, the quantum and theory being played out, and with three people experience the same event, you know, we're in the same space, we're each experiencing in a very different way, vastly different ways and vastly different perspectives. We think that there are factually that things happen in certain ways or from our perspective, you know, this definitely happened and this is definitely how it happened. But we all experience and our experience of it is very different. And then you know, there was another quote, from the questions about ownership, like about you know, we talk about children and whether or not these are our children or whether or not they're what was the question? Let me see. There was an interesting way it was phrased here about whether or not they're just somewhere where, in regards to motherhood and children, your experience of that and how your experience informed the novel.
In terms of my own personal experience?
Motherhood, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I mentioned, like my experience of having two different kids certainly made me think. I mean, you know, you just think about like, where do they come from? You know, they're just there, but they have these, their own kind of personalities and predilections. And so I think that definitely had an impact on me, but also, just personally, motherhood helped me get out of my own way in terms of just being caught up in my head and my, you know, kind of like self-absorption, which is just always good for anything to get out of that. But I also feel like, you know, there's a Buddhist view that was in my head as I was sort of, because I remembered it before I was a Buddhist when I took a class way back when, that we've all been born and reborn so many times, like from, you know, countless previous lives, that every single person alive was once our mother. And I thought that's such a powerful thought, that like you guys were my mother, I was your mother. Like we've all been kind of playing these roles to each other. And I think for myself to think of, because it's a very, you know, you feel it's a super powerful experience, you know, to have like, oh, these kids are, I'm responsible for them. But then to try to take that same level of kind of love and compassion and responsibility and to just expand it out, which is challenging for us, for me. But I also feel like if you really hold that thought, just the possibility of that in your head, that like everybody was related to us intimately, then like how can we justify the way that as a society we treat each other? Like it's completely illogical. You know, it makes no sense. We're hurting our children. We're hurting our mothers, you know? And so I think just, you know, even if you think, if you're listening, you know, if you think reincarnation is bunk, and many, many people don't believe, and I am totally fine, you can still see this entire, like, book or process as a metaphor for the fact that we're connected to each other. We're all connected in
all
this particular
together.
Way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that like focusing on that as opposed to focusing on the ways that we disagree with each other will lead us in like such a more positive, powerful direction. And we seem to be doing the opposite so much of the time.
Yeah, I found the quote here. Jenny recalls Sweet Honey in the Rock song. Your children are not your children, though they are with you. They belong not to you. So it's interesting how we think about, you know, whether we're the dreamer or whether or not we're in the dream, you know, kind of that action or the possession or the grasping at specifics of like that ownership and possession and stuff like that. So it's interesting to think about and contemplate how the dream is happening, unfolding, experience unfolding, and that we're not the doer, you know?
Exactly. That's actually a Khalil Gibran quote, which I regret that I attributed it to Sweet Honey in the Rock for various reasons, but that's where it came from originally.
Oh,
but
okay.
But yeah, exactly. It's where we get so you know, it's like we're really grasping at all these, you know, my kids. But even at the most conventional level, I mean, I got a 16-year-old and he's going to go off to college soon and he's having his own life, you know, even at the most basic level that everyone understands is we grow up and we don't own each other.
And you know? And as a writer, the same can be said, too, about the work that we produce. Like we can put all of our efforts to force our reader to have this experience, or we can recognize that as soon as we put the word on the page and put it out into the world, it's going to have a different life for everybody. That the things that we, and this is part of why literature is dynamic and why literature will never die, because yeah. Every time we read a story, it tells itself again and in a different way. And as writers, I think it's really important that we also let our little darlings go and let our readers do with it, have their own experiences with them. And it can be easy to forget that once they're off our screen and on somebody in somebody else's lap or on somebody else's screen, that all of those things we write are open to interpretation and to having a different meaning for every single person who reads them. And it's part of how it works.
Absolutely. We have no control of it anyway.
Right.
But the idea that there's not, like, I mean, this is kind of a Buddhist idea. There's not like a book. There's
right.
just, you know what
there's
I mean?
There's an experience.
There's all these
potential
pages
experience.
Together yeah. and everybody experiences it. Each person experiences it completely differently. And it's so, you know, that's.
And that's the success of literature, not the failing of literature. A lot of people who first start writing think that the goal of the writer is to force something to happen, like to control the outcome, when really it's to create the potentiality of an infinite number of experiences.
That's beautiful. Yeah. And that's kind of everything. Like we can't control anything. We just create potentialities. And I mean, it's kind of fun. It's kind of interesting because now with the way that Goodreads and Amazon and everything, you see people's responses. Mm-hmm. And so at first you're like, everyone who doesn't give you like a 5-star yeah. or 4-star, you're like, like I remember like somebody else better write something good because that person didn't like it. And then after yeah. a while, you know, it's interesting. So somebody, you know, I get people who like will write me letters about how it consoled them for some huge loss, or this was like a big, huge, you know, like they so enjoyed it and it caused them to rethink their views of reality or whatever. And then people who were like, yeah, it was a good fast read. It. I read it an hour and a half on the beach, but I can't really remember it, but it was fun. Yeah. And then
forgetting
other people,
time.
Yeah. Exactly. People have said that. And then other people who were like, somebody wrote just as an Amazon review, no, 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 no. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And in some ways I didn't mind it because I obviously had like hit a nerve with that person, but you know, and then other people like, you know, so it's kind of it humbles you, but in a good way, because it shows you like, you know, again, it's my name is on this thing, but it's just this sort of this, you know, book that arose from so many different, you know, causes and so many different influences. And it's out there having different, you know, and people are having different reactions to it or no reactions to it. So.
Yeah. And as we start to close up, I'll just mention The Forgetting Time is Book Brow's 12 Best Books for Book Clubs in 2017, Amazon's UK Rising Amazon UK Rising Star 2016, Booklist Top 10 Debut Novels in 2016, the audiobook, and Indie Next Pick. So I definitely recommend people check it out and keep their mind open to different you know, thoughts and different philosophies and such. So also, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, Truth to Power Show. If you'd like to, Truth to Power Show is can be found, the archives can be found at Podomatic and iTunes. And Radio Free Brooklyn is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a free and open platform to our community and promote media literacy, education, and free expression. We rely primarily on donations from listeners like you who like to support our mission. And so we can continue to bring us quality community radio, we invite you to make a one-time donation or monthly pledge at radioforbrooklyn.org/donate. Also, just one more quick announcement. Radio for Brooklyn presents Love Honey at Orleans Grocery, 9/27/2018. So if you'd like to join, you can go to ticketfly.com and join that event. Also, Sharon, you wanted to mention something about political. You want to?
Oh, yeah. Just that I've been volunteering a little bit with an organization called Changing the Conversation Together. It's a grassroots organization that does deep canvassing, having long, respectful conversations with swing voters right now in Staten Island and elsewhere. I'm actually co-hosting an event, if you're interested, in on this Thursday to sort of show people a little more about it at my house in Park Slope. If you're interested, you can email me at Sharon@SharonGuskin.com. That's Thursday, September 27th. And if this sounds interesting to you, it's called Changing the Conversation Together. It's a New York-based grassroots organization that's trying to have a really empathic, positive way to talk to voters and perhaps persuade them that some checks and balances might be useful in this country.
And just one last thing, if you haven't quite gotten enough of Vijay and Claire for 1 week, you can also join us on Thursday at 6:30 at the Forest Hills Public Library, where we will be kicking off the Queens Public Library reading series at Forest Hills.
Yeah,
and
open
I'll
mic.
Be reading from some fiction for the first time ever. And Vijay's going to do some poems after that. And then there will be lots of open micers, open miking and stuff. So you should join us at the Forest Hills Library on Thursday at 6:30.
Yeah, it's every last Thursday of the month. So if you can't make it this time, definitely stop by and
but you should make it this time. Mic.
Make it this time, yeah. All right, so I'll close out with the Where's My Mind Pixie, just continuing that, the Pixies' Where's My Mind, continuing that song. Since I think it seems a very appropriate kind of lyrics and such, so we'll close out with that. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
Stop.